It is not very easy for those countries, but on the other hand, they know that the future of the world is going to the multipolar world, so they couldn't rely on United States, just on the United States for their security, for economic, for other things. So we can, we have to see in the next years what's going on with the Saudi-Israeli cooperation and negotiation behind the scene, and it would tell us what is the future destiny of the Saudi Arabia to join BRICS or not.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Yusuf Azizi, international affairs expert, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, speaking to us from Brussels. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of Spotlight. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's show. It's good night for now, and see you next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dha min ba'din, wallahu samiyun alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم. فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم. فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing. And when she bore her, she said, My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, O Mary, from where does this come for you? She said, It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
In the United States, three people have been killed at a store in Jacksonville, Florida, by a white gunman in what police say was a racist rampage targeting black people. At least five Palestinians have been injured in another Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank. And a key ally of former UK Prime Minister Johnson has resigned as a member of parliament with a scathing attack on Prime Minister Rishi Sunak.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital of Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
In the United States, three people have been killed at a store in Jacksonville, Florida, by a white gunman in what police say was a racist rampage targeting black people.
This afternoon, a little after 1 p.m., an individual we have not yet officially identified entered a Dollar Tree in a Newtown area of Jacksonville, outfitted with a tactical vest, armed with an AR-style rifle, and a handgun. Then the shooter killed three people before turning the gun on himself, taking his own life. Other than the three individuals killed and the shooter himself, there are no additional people who suffered gunshot wounds. We are not identifying the deceased victims at this time, but I can tell you there are two male victims and one female victim. All of the deceased victims are black. This shooting was racially motivated, and he hated black people. He wanted to kill niggers. That's the one and only time I'll use that word. In Jacksonville's history.
Police said the shooter was armed with a high-powered rifle that was marked by swastikas. Officials said the suspect had left messages that detailed his hatred for black people. The FBI said federal officials had opened a civil rights investigation and would pursue the incident as a hate crime. At least five Palestinians have been injured in another Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank. The regime forces stormed the northern city of Tulkarm, prompting violent clashes with resistance fighters. Tensions have been running high across the occupied West Bank in recent months as Israeli troops launched near daily raids there. Palestinians have increasingly also been fighting back and launching retaliatory operations. On Saturday, the regime forces stormed the village near the city of Jenin and arrested several Palestinians. However, they were forced to retreat after coming under fire from resistance fighters. Around 230 Palestinians have been killed at the hands of Israeli forces this year, and many others have been arrested. A correspondent from Ramallah, Monica Ndil, earlier joined us for more details about the Israeli raid.
Early on Sunday, Israeli military raided Tulkarem city and remained there for over 4 hours. According to the residents of Tulkarem, they said that Israeli troops conducted an arrest raid. A number of Palestinians had been wounded, but the exact number is still unknown. Exchange of fire erupted between Israeli forces and the Palestinian fighters. Members of resistance groups from the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade and Saraya Al-Quds, the armed wing of the Jihad movement, according to those resistance groups who issued statements this morning, saying that their fighters exchanged of fire and clashed with the Israeli forces for several hours in Tulkarem. Their fighters also hurled explosive devices at the Israeli military vehicles that forced the Israeli troops to end their military raid, and it was not a widespread military raid. However, during this operation, at least 5 Palestinians had been wounded. One of them has been shot in the his hand, and he was in a serious condition, according to Palestinian paramedics.
Protests over the judicial overhaul plan proposed by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right cabinet continues for the 34th consecutive week. Protesters are saying the 200-plus different proposals are turning Israel into a dictatorship. They say the regime is trying to control the Supreme Court and thus all 3 systems in Israel. The opposition believes the cabinet is aiming to weaken the judiciary and to prevent it from being able to maintain checks and balances on the cabinet. The opposition has also said that Netanyahu, who is currently on trial on charges of several counts of corruption, tries to use this scheme to quash possible judgments against him. Israel is facing public unrest, labor strikes, and mutiny by some members of the military. Lebanon says it has busted members of an Israeli spy cell at Beirut's Rafik Hariri International Airport. According to Lebanon's chief of public security, 2 people were arrested while attempting to leave Lebanon and were handed over to Lebanon's judiciary. The official said the cell was tasked with missions inside the country and that they will reveal more details on the group's activities in the future. The Israeli regime has a vast espionage apparatus and has conducted numerous spy operations against Palestinians and regional countries. Lebanese security services have arrested dozens over the years on suspicion of collaborating with Israel, with some receiving jail terms of up to 25 years. A correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, earlier joined us with more details on the arrests of the Israeli spies.
This time it wasn't done through Lebanese collaborators, actually. It was done through perhaps Israelis themselves who were using Russian passports. And that is one of the possibilities that we know. Of course, we were told by head of the internal security that he will give us more details later. But what we do know right now is that this is a cell comprised of 2 individuals. And they will be, of course, gathering more information through the interrogations. And of course, that will probably lead to other individuals who are implicated in this cell or other cells as well. But as you know, we have various cells that are working within Lebanon. Not every single cell is working with the other, but usually the Israelis are working with all of these cells. Now, we do have, of course, very high incidence of Israeli espionage activity, especially after the 2019 economic crisis. We noticed how that really peaked. We have over 185 individuals who were arrested since 2019 until 2022. A lot of them are even employees in the telecommunications sector. Perhaps they were trying to get more information through telecoms from members of Hezbollah, getting more information on the activity of the resistance in Lebanon.
British MP and former Minister Nadine Dorries has resigned from the Commons, accusing the Premier Rishi Sunak of endangering her safety by whipping up a public frenzy against her. Dorries lashed out at Sunak, saying that he had abandoned conservative principles. She also said that the country is being run by a zombie parliament. Dorries was a key ally of former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. In June, she announced her plan to quit with immediate effect after she was denied a seat in the House of Lords. Dorries accused Sunak's government of removing her name from the list and said she wanted to know why she was refused a seat. Researcher and political analyst Christopher Halali joined us earlier for comments. Here's his explanation about the resignation of the Conservative British MP and its political ramifications.
It's very deep and troubling what's going on in the United Kingdom at this point. We see with the MP that just resigned, Nadine, that there's a lot of upheaval in the Conservative Party. Of course, she's hurled a lot of vitriol and accusations at Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Of course, she's from the wing of the Conservative Party, very loyal to former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. She was, of course, a Secretary of Culture under him. And so right now she's saying that Rishi Sunak is destroying the Conservative Party. He's created a zombie parliament. Nothing's getting done. Business is leaving London for the United States. And so she's deeply concerned about the situation. And part of this is a new book she has coming out now that she's resigned about the plot to destroy Boris Johnson and obviously to destroy the Conservative Party and the faction that she belongs to. So there's a lot of turmoil going on in the Conservative Party, no doubt. And this, of course, is a boon to the Labour Party, to the Liberal Democrats, to the Greens and to others who are going to sense blood in the water, and they're going to try to take those seats away from Conservatives who have by-elections coming up.
The number of bankruptcy declarations of EU businesses keeps soaring at a fast pace. Eastern European countries have been recording the highest rates over the past months, but the situation in Italy has been worrying for years. Max Giubilli has more from Rome.
The EU statistical agency Eurostat's latest report on business registrations and bankruptcies leaves little room for interpretation. Small and medium businesses across the old continent are struggling amid the unprecedented challenges posed by some global events such as the COVID-19 pandemic, the energy crisis, high levels of inflation and high interest rates. Bankruptcy declarations in the European Union reached the highest level since 2015 in the second quarter of this year. The number of closures in the April-June period was 8% higher than the previous quarter, marking a sixth consecutive increase. Hungary, Latvia and Estonia have recorded the highest number of enterprises declaring bankrupt in 2023.
It is important to stress that Eastern European countries benefited enormously from delocalization over the past two decades. Today, the enduring effects of the many crises are also evident on the Eastern Europe.
A sharp increase in the number of bankruptcy declarations has been recorded in the accommodation and food services sectors across the whole old continent. Registrations of new businesses are declining. The clock is ticking in Italy as well. The Confederation of Italian Enterprises, Confindustria, has reported that about 120,000 companies in Italy are facing bankruptcy and as many as 370,000 jobs are at stake. Soaring gas and energy prices, high inflation and the rising cost of borrowing money have worsened an already difficult situation. For over 15 years, the exit rate of companies in the country has been much higher than the entry rate. According to the authoritative agency CERVED, hundreds of thousands of companies have closed and millions of jobs have gone wasted since 2008. CERVED estimates that about 3 million workers risk losing their jobs in the coming months.
In his maiden speech to the Upper House in 2021, former Prime Minister Mario Draghi pointed out that a new selective industrial policy discussed by the members of the G30 was needed to limit the rising number of the so-called zombie companies, those firms unable to pay their long-term debts. It goes without saying that Italy's workers and small and medium-sized enterprises, which account for the vast majority of Italian firms, are bearing the brunt of this policy.
Our Western economic systems are connected like communicating vessels. In my view, things will get worse as the vessels are connected too tightly.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine and the curtailment of Russian pipeline gas supplies to Europe, companies in energy-intensive sectors have been the most affected. Max Civili, Rome.
Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa has won a second term in office. Official results announced by the country's electoral commission indicate that he won 52.6% of the ballots against 44% for the main challenger, Nelson Chamisa. However, the opposition has rejected the results, making accusations of vote rigging and voter suppression. The opposition hoped to emerge victorious due to the wave of discontent over the poor economic situation in the country. Mnangagwa's ruling ZANU-PF party was also declared the winner in the parliamentary race. Voter turnout was around 70%. Anti-French sentiment is growing in Niger after Paris defiantly insisted the military government in Niamey cannot expel its ambassador. Military leaders now have called on people to turn up and to show their support for the government. They're saying the French envoy must leave the country.
The fight will not stop until the day there is no longer any French soldiers in Niger. We told them to leave our country to us, to leave, to let our country be. But it's you who will chase them away. To chase them away, don't go to the embassy. If the mobilization continues, they'll leave.
The French have been asked to leave, but they refused. We are going to defeat those plotting against our country. We are going to defeat them and stomp them out.
Victory to the people. It is the people of Niger who will decide what will become of this country. United, we stand.
Tens of thousands of people rallied in a stadium in the capital wearing and waving the country's flag. They expressed their full support for the country's military government that came to power following last month's coup. They also urged Western countries, especially France, to respect their choice of government. The military leaders in Niamey have accused Paris of seeking to use force in order to reinstate the ousted president. On Friday, they gave France's ambassador 48 hours to leave the country. There seems to be no end to the legal troubles surrounding former U.S. President Donald Trump. In a new case, the Republican figure has been booked at a jail in Atlanta, Georgia. He was released after posting a $200,000 bond and accepting bail conditions that bar him from threatening witnesses or his co-defendants in the case. Ramin Mazari has more from Chicago.
For the first time in United States history, a former president now has a mugshot. Donald Trump has been arrested in Georgia and is being prosecuted under racketeering charges for allegedly trying to subvert the state's 2020 presidential election votes. 70% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents still say President Joe Biden's election was not legitimate.
You should be able to challenge an election. I thought the election was a rigged election, a stolen election, and I should have every right to do that. As you know, you have many people that you've been watching over the years do the same thing, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Stacey Abrams or many others.
It's the fourth arrest for Trump in 5 months, even as Trump is running neck and neck with Biden in 2024 election polls. That has many accusing the ruling Democrats of election interference and of weaponizing the judicial system against political opponents, and of dangerously dividing the country. Trump's popularity among Republicans has soared since the first indictment, and he seems certain to be their candidate next year. Polls show the nation is almost perfectly split regarding Trump's 4 court cases and 91 felony charges. While a part of the United States has become galvanized both for and against Trump, for decades the United States has been defined by political apathy, low voter turnout rates, and disinterest in Washington politics seen as so corrupt it's routinely referred to as the swamp.
It seems like a lot of work, and typically I feel like people that high up don't really ever get convicted of anything, so it might be a lot of time and money and effort going towards nothing at the end, so I don't know.
The 2024 presidential campaign began this week with the first Republican Party primary debate, but the focus was on Donald Trump, and the focus will likely remain on Trump for at least the next 15 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Many Maui survivors say the U.S. government response to the recent wildfire in the island has been inadequate and slow. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Global Times noted, news of the devastating wildfire on the Hawaiian island of Maui reminds Chinese oceanologist Wang Yamin of the pristine island he visited 9 years ago. Wang still remembered the days when he was amazed by the dazzling blue ocean, the lush green of the trees, and the pretty little houses hidden among vegetation. During an academic trip to Hawaii in August 2014, Wang lived in the renowned historical town of Lahaina and hiked up the mountain in the early mornings to watch the glorious sunrise. However, now Lahaina was tragically and almost entirely leveled by the sudden fire. The fire, which started on August 8, has reportedly killed at least 114 people and left over 1,000 unaccounted for to date, and is considered one of the deadliest wildfires in modern American history. Wang sighed, saying, "What a pity for Moy and his people." The fire not only resulted in numerous casualties, but also destroyed much of the island's vegetation and caused air and marine pollution. Days on, the international community has witnessed just how much this wildfire has turned part of Maui, once a land of idyllic beauty, into a scene of horror, carnage, and ruin straight out of a Hollywood horror movie. Worse still, the island's broken early warning system, slow and poorly coordinated rescue efforts, and the U.S. disappointing disaster response and mobilization mechanisms have, to some extent, transformed the natural tragedy into a man-made one, as observers point out. Strong storms, high temperatures, offshore rescue, and other objective factors do make the rescue process and efforts in Maui more difficult. Emergency management specialist Wan Yan Hua, a professor at Hua Chong University of Science and Technology, told Global Times, "However, the human factors that led to the ineffective rescue operations cannot be ignored." U.S. President Joe Biden eventually landed on Maui recently after his vacation at Delaware Beach. It had been 13 days since the island was hard hit by the deadly wildfire. The House earlier claimed that Biden-Harris administration had mobilized a robust whole-of-government response effort to support immediate and long-term rescue and recovery efforts in Maui. Dozens of federal departments and agencies have been working with state and local partners on the ground to assess emergent needs and providing resources and personnel to support response efforts, the White House website claimed on August 15th. But such rhetoric has done little to assuage people's anger at the slow response the U.S. government during the ongoing tragedy. Not until August 10th did Biden approve the disaster declaration for Hawaii and unlock federal rescue resources to be used in Maui, nearly 2 days after the fire broke out. Hawaii News Now reported on August 11th, let alone the criticism garnered from the president telling reporters during his beach getaway that he had no comment to the rising death toll in Maui. Delays in the arrival of outside help undoubtedly intensified people's suffering. It was a kind of fear and panic that I have never experienced before in my life, hotel manager Kawina Kahula told CBS News on August 15th. Kahula recalled that she didn't see any first responders when she self-evacuated a short drive from Lahaina. While Lahaina sat in ruins, no assistance came for 2 days, Kahula said to CBS. Washington Post said recently thousands of grief-stricken survivors questioned the competence and capability of the government. Moi local Kai Lenny also said, "We were just in shock, and it was just like day after day. Where are they?" Dozens of calls were made by the Global Times to local restaurants, hotels, and shops during local business hours at the weekend. Only 3 answered the phone. "We are still open," a restaurant staffer told the Global Times, adding, "I have some friends who are in a bad situation. There is not much outside help." It's hard to know when Mo'oi, including its pillar tourism industry, will fully recover from the devastation of the wildfires. In an email reply to the Global Times recently, T. Ilihia Gionson, a public affairs officer at the Hawaii Tourism Authority, said a request was made that visitors avoid going to West Mo'oi, the resort areas of Lahaina, Kanapali, and Kapula. Gibbonson told Global Times, "In the early hours of this disaster, we worked to get visitors off the island of Mo'oi to allow attention and resources to be focused on the people of Mo'oi. We ask that visitors be mindful that Hawaii is a small community and that many people may have strong connections to those who were affected by the tragedy." Early damage assessments related to the fire showed that as of August 11th, 2,719 structures were exposed, 2,207 structures were damaged or destroyed, and 2,170 acres were burnt, according to the U.S. Pacific Disaster Center and the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Hawaii Governor Josh Green estimated that Mo'oi is facing nearly $6 billion worth of damage, and that is according to CNN, who had this report on August 19th. With dry weather, complex terrain, and gale-force winds, Mo'oi is a high-risk area for wildfires. The island's relatively weak firefighting capability that doesn't match its fire risk has therefore become a focus of public concern in light of the recent deadly disaster. The island had only about 65 firefighters on call and 13 fire engines designed for urban use rather than off-road or wildland use, and that is according to Guardian, who reported on August 11th. Bobby Lee, the president of Hawaii Firefighters Association, told the media, "You are basically dealing with trying to fight a blowtorch," when describing the huge mismatch between the firefighting capability of the island and the scale of the wildfire on Mo'oi. According to Los Angeles Times, a raging fire burning directly into densely populated areas. A historic city built between the ocean and a volcano with limited escape routes. Gale force winds that left firefighters on the defensive. In the wake of the deadliest U.S. wildfire in a century, officials in Hawaii have at times insisted that little could have been done to avoid the tragedy that obliterated a historic West Mo'oi town and killed scores of residents. Hawaii Governor Josh Green recently said the largest force at play were 80 meters per hour winds. "We have doubts that much could have been done," with a fiery, fast-moving fire like that. Yet, there is plenty of evidence that government officials should have been aware of the danger to Lahaina, home to generations of Hawaiian families and once home of the Hawaiian king. And what makes the wildfire all the more tragic, forever linking the town with unspeakable sorrow, is there was actually far more time to sound an alarm.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in this program, we will discuss America's horrendous legacy in Afghanistan. So, stay with us.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss a trail of US misdeeds in Afghanistan. And we shall also take a look at the motive behind launching the so-called War on Terror.
The withdrawal of the United States from Afghanistan 2 decades after its unwanted arrival in the country left behind a nation grappling with uncertainty and turmoil. As we mark 2 years since its shameful exit from Afghan soil, it is imperative to remember the long list of human rights violations during its military presence in the country. While the West claimed that the so-called War on Terror brought stability in the country, the reality is otherwise. Civilian casualties, indiscriminate airstrikes, unlawful detentions, and other crimes against humanity form a part of the harrowing reality.
The Operation Enduring Freedom, led by the United States, was launched in 2001 under the pretext of dismantling the Taliban regime. However, the outcome has been marred by a grim legacy. Since 2001, an estimated 75,000 Afghan military and police personnel and more than 71,000 civilians have lost their lives. Reports reveal that NATO-led airstrikes resulted in the death of nearly 1,600 children just between 2016 and 2020. Unlawful detentions became another contentious issue, with tens of thousands held without charges or access to legal representation. According to reports, 70 to 90% of detainees were rounded up without proper evidence. Secret trials, based on questionable allegations, raised concern with no substantial action ever taken. According to human rights experts, the actions of the US government in Afghanistan were a failure, and the military occupation was not only the political hegemony of the United States, but also the hegemony of the West.
The U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, falsely justified under the banner of counterterrorism, reveals a more complex narrative. While the pretext of America's longest war was to eradicate the Taliban and al-Qaeda, deeper motives that fueled the Afghan war are often overlooked. Buried lies a tale of strategic maneuvering, political interests, pursuit of the mineral wealth of Afghanistan, and the astonishing surge in opium production that unfolded in the aftermath of the U.S. invasion.
Afghanistan's tumultuous history has been marked by decades of conflict, with the opium trade contributing to the violence in the region. Before the US invasion, the Taliban had banned opium production as it went against the laws of Islam. When the US-led invasion ousted the Taliban regime in the early 2000s, paradoxically, opium production surged, transforming Afghanistan into the world's largest producer, accounting for a startling 90% of global output. United Nations data shows a 35-fold increase in opium production since the US intervention, rising from 185 tons in 2001 to a staggering 6,400 tons in the recent years. While the official narrative claimed to fight terrorism, the US forces openly guarded poppy fields in the Afghan countryside and maintained connections with Afghan drug kingpins. According to some political observers, economic interests attracted America to Afghanistan and not the false rhetoric of cracking down on terrorist groups. Strategic relation experts say that the US invaded Afghanistan to loot its vast mineral wealth, including the huge lithium deposits, and to resurrect the poppy fields.
Minerals were one thing that the US was eyeing in Afghanistan or was greedy for in Afghanistan, it could have easily struck deal with whoever was in power in Kabul. That is what we are seeing now. The Chinese and other countries are rushing to Kabul to talk to the Taliban and get the rights to excavate, dig out minerals that are in abundance in Afghanistan. But I think the US did not go in for economic reasons. It went in for geo-security reasons to Afghanistan. As I said earlier, the aim was to make Soviet Union bleed. And I think everyone knows that it's because of the defeat of Soviet Union in Afghanistan that the whole Soviet Union then afterwards broke up.
Now let's talk about the women of Afghanistan. By omitting the history of the crimes committed by the NATO military alliance in Afghanistan, the United States has been trying to show itself as a rescuer of Afghan women. However, figures show the real picture. As per statistical data, after 20 years of U.S. presence in Afghanistan, various forms of violence against the Afghan women have increased. Experts say there has been an astronomical rise in cases of self-immolation, trafficking, prostitution and kidnapping in the past 2 decades.
During the 2-decade occupation of Afghanistan, United States used Afghan women as a symbol to legitimate their bombing campaign in the country and also justify their war on terror. Claiming that the so-called war on terror was also a fight to restore the rights and dignity of Afghan women, the Bush administration declared that the U.S. was able to liberate the Afghan women and guarantee them a rightful place in the society. Rejecting West's claim of women empowerment, Afghan women rights activists have been saying that the world has maintained a total silence over the atrocities committed against women during the U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Well, Afghan women sadly have been the most affected segment of the Afghan society over the last 20 or 40 years. And the problem is that they have not been seen as sort of a very important segment of society, which nobody can win a war without the help or support of women in Afghanistan. And I think if you analytically look at the data as well, I'm not sure, but I think Afghan women widows would be one of the ratio of widow in Afghanistan would be one of the highest in the world, if not the topmost. So Afghan women have, suffered not just because of the war, but of the economic situation on the ground as well. They have suffered poverty, they have suffered a lot of problems in the last 20 years. When the US was waging a war in Afghanistan, the only aim it had was to achieve a military success in that area. And if it affected women or men or children, they didn't care about at that time. They did say on the surface that they are supporting them through NGOs and welfare funds. But I think that was very little amount that actually got to these women.
Experts say that the early expressions of support for Afghan women in the midst of US military action served to paint a feminist glow on some of the most brutal bombings by America and its allies. Despite Western declaration of empowering the Afghan women, the female literacy rate in the country has not changed in the last 20 years. And the horrors the Afghan women suffered during the violent two-decade U.S. occupation of the country still remain enshrouded in mystery.
We hardly get to hear about Afghan refugees in Western media and the severity of the Afghan refugee crisis. The humanitarian catastrophe brought by the two decades of U.S. occupation made millions of Afghans homeless. The destruction inflicted on civilians by the so-called war on terror has been incalculable. The figures given by the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, shows that at the end of 2020, there were around 2.8 million Afghan refugees worldwide, the vast majority of them in Iran and Pakistan. However, the actual number of displacements are probably twice the number.
Statistics show that at least 37 million people have fled their homes during the wars the U.S. military has launched since 2001. However, experts believe the total displaced by the U.S. post-9/11 wars could be closer to 48 to 59 million, as the international statistics generally count only the registered refugees. According to a 2020 research paper written by a joint research team from the U.S. universities of Boston and Brown, in 2015, there were almost as many unregistered Afghan refugees in Pakistan, around 1.3 million, as there were registered refugees, which happens to be 1.5 million. Analysts say that this huge influx of refugees to the neighboring countries has led to socio-cultural, economic, and political effects in the host states, also putting pressure on their resources.
Well, it has been, of course, mishandled on a mammoth scale, for sure. Otherwise, we would not have been where we are today in Afghanistan. From day one, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, the U.S. policy and its allies' policy vis-a-vis Afghanistan has been one of the failures after another one. We have seen that in the last two decades, they managed to bring in a system, a democratic system in Afghanistan on artificial basis that could not survive once they decided to leave. It fell apart the next day when the Americans left Afghanistan. The policy, if we are to assess Afghanistan's situation, we shouldn't be assessing it on the basis of the last 20 years. It should be, it's been more than 40 years that the US CIA and its allies like Pakistan have been trying to maneuver situation in Afghanistan, and they have not been successful in achieving what they wanted to achieve, a democratic Afghanistan.
As per experts, during the 20 years of its presence in Afghanistan, the United States played an essential role in breaking the Afghan society, leaving the people in desperate condition. The displacement caused by the U.S. war in Afghanistan has torn apart families, neighborhoods, communities, alongside other forms of wartime violence.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insights on this, we are joined by political analyst and journalist Mr. Tahir Khan from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome. Now, sir, the U.S. military withdrew from Afghanistan after 20 years of occupation. What has been the implications of this hasty withdrawal on the stability of the country, and also why why the so quick withdrawal of the U.S. military forces?
Thank you for inviting me. I would not say a hasty withdrawal because the U.S. and its NATO allies, they had already decided to leave Afghanistan because they were not successful. And they were the Taliban fighting against the foreign troops. They forced them to come to the negotiation table because the U.S. and the NATO allies were expecting that they would weaken the Taliban. And after the Taliban are weakened, they would go for the negotiation. But that was that approach was not, I think, based on realities. So this was the already the American had in mind to leave Afghanistan. And you would know the Taliban and Qatar and the U.S. A former ambassador to Pakistan and Afghanistan, Richard Olson, for the first time in 2015, they started interaction. But the formal negotiations started in 2018. And so the American had a plan to leave Afghanistan because they did not achieve what they wanted to, because they want to finish the Taliban. They want to punish the Taliban. This was their claim. But Taliban were more stronger, and the American could not achieve their objectives. That's why they withdrew. So I would not say it was a hasty decision, but because they were not successful to defeat the Taliban.
Okay, so talking about Taliban, with the withdrawal of U.S. troops, Afghanistan faced a rapid shift in power. What factors allowed the Taliban to regain control so swiftly?
Yes, I would say one factor was the division among the leaders in Afghanistan that time. Dr. Ashraf Ghani and Dr. Abdullah, they both took oath as president. So it never happened in anywhere. I don't think it happened anywhere in the world. So there was division within the political leadership. And I would say the Afghan National Army was tired, I would say. And they were under psychological stress when the Americans and the Taliban signed the agreement in 2020 on February 29. So that withdrawal agreement was a psychological pressure on the Afghan forces. The second factor was the people did not want more war because Taliban were fighting in villages, in rural areas, in mountains, and sometime on the road just to explode a bomb. But the people, there was no fighting in the cities. So the cities were safe. And that's why the people in when the Taliban started controlling the provinces, they started from the northern provinces. And Taliban had never been any influence in the north. But because of the people frustration over the war, they forced their officials in different provinces to hand over the provinces to the Taliban. So Taliban started from the north. They took control of several provinces in the north. This encouraged the Taliban in the east, in the west, in the south to move forward because the army did not want to fight to fight more. The people were not willing that the war should be shifted to the cities from the villages. This was the main factors: political division, the morale of the Afghan forces, and the people pressure on the leadership that they don't want more war. So this paved the way for the Taliban to take control of Afghanistan.
Mr. Tahir Khan, there was another thing I wanted to ask. Was the U.S., when they left, the reason I used their swift withdrawal was because they left a lot of their equipment behind, which is like worth millions of dollars. What is the reason behind that?
I was in Kabul in July, in the last week of July, and I went to the defense ministry in Kabul, and I met some official there. I was told by one Taliban leader, defense official, Major General Abdul Latif Hakimi, who was previously the Taliban spokesman when there was a war in Afghanistan. He was telling me that the Americans destroyed many, many things, even the airfields and some infrastructure they have built. And even they tried to damage the tanks and everything. But they could not shift everything. They destroyed many things. So that's why the Taliban government now trying to repair some of the tanks, the helicopters, and other military vehicles. But the American could not take more weapons with them, so because they want to leave Afghanistan.
That's right, sir. Mr. Tahir Khan, the so-called war on terror in Afghanistan led to serious human rights violations by the NATO troops. Now, the perpetrators of the war crimes are still free. Why have the world organizations have been silent over this?
Now, this is a very good question. I would say the double standard of the Western countries, the double standard of the international, some organizations like International Court of Justice, War Criminal Courts, if people were killed in Afghanistan, there were strikes on the wedding ceremonies in Afghanistan, many civilians were killed. So in, they say this is not a human human violation. And the Guantanamo is Guantanamo was for everyone, because you may have heard from the prisoner who spent time in Guantanamo, because I met several the Guantanamo former prisoners. They faced a lot of problems there. So this is the double standard. I would say very briefly that the West, the Americans, the other Western European countries, they have a double standard. For them, human rights is issue is when it favors them. And for in other countries like Afghanistan, like Iraq, like Syria, when people are killed by the Americans or other countries, so for the Americans and the NATO and the European, this is not, so I would say this is double standard. And we still face this approach by the US and the Western allies.
That's right, sir. Before we let you go, sir, one last question. Despite claims,
please.
I want to talk about the opium trade. Despite claims to curtail opium trade, the production of opium remained high during the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. So my question would be, how did the United States benefit from the drug trade?
This is very simple. If I don't stop the poppy production, poppy opium cultivation, and then they knew, because the Taliban, the American forces were everywhere. I myself visited Helmand, which was the main provinces for these opium production. And believe me, I have seen on the main roads huge fields of this opium production, the cultivation of the opium poppy. The problem is they were, you are right, they were not, they could stop this cultivation of this opium and this drug, but they did not. So, because there was war. There was a war, and they were the control of those areas, but they did not stop them. So it means if you don't stop poppy cultivation or narcotic smuggling, it means you have benefit of all these things. And this war, this American war in Afghanistan, the NATO war in Afghanistan, every time you can, if you go to the media in the past, the Americans' factories of the weapons, some Western interests, they were involved in that war, because it was the war was run in Afghanistan by the American Western interests. So the opium production, I think they would be definitely benefiting them if they did not stop those poppy cultivation. And the problem is Americans have left. Americans have gone. They were, I would say, they were defeated. But they left the weapons problem for the neighboring countries, for Afghans, the opium issue. So now Iran, Pakistan, Central Asia, they are facing multiple problems because of the war in Afghanistan. And the Americans are now safe in Washington and New York, and we are facing the problem.
So if you could just shortly tell me, how has the government now contained the opium problem?
I think they had, I would say, I would not say 100% control, because, you know, the Taliban also, they knew that if there is no alternative to the opium, so although their leader, the Amir, has already banned this, and in many areas, in Helmand and other areas, which was traditionally the poppy cultivation areas, I have also heard from many people that now this is not very easy for the very traditional these poppy, the people who are involved in the cultivation, in the business. So to some extent, I would say it has been controlled. But I would not say that fully the Taliban have controlled this, because the Taliban also know that if you totally ban these things, so maybe the people would suffer, and the people who are depending on this. And the second thing is the international community, especially the West, who brought the war to Afghanistan, they are not very interested to help the common people. Because when I was in Helmand last year, the local people were telling me that they were forced to stop the cultivation, but they were complaining that they were not given the alternative. So the Americans, the European, and the NATO, they should help those people who were forced to stop this cultivation of the poppy.
They had 20 years to do this. Mr. Tahir Khan, thank you for being with us, sir.
Welcome. Thank you, sir.
There you have it, political analyst and journalist Mr. Tahir Khan from Islamabad. Glad to have him on the program. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Izzat Ghafouri, a journalist, tweeted, "My pen is unable to write their pain. The crimes of America and England in Afghanistan are unforgivable. This young man was 10 years old when his father, mother, and three sisters and three little brothers were bombed and dismembered." Nar Edley, founder and director of Mint Press News, wrote, "In 2016, when the US military dropped bombs on Doctors Without Borders Trauma Hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, killing over 40 people and injuring hundreds more, the Pentagon investigated itself and concluded it didn't commit war crimes." Asif Durrani, Pakistan's special representative on Afghanistan, tweeted, "Being the champion of human rights, the US should voluntarily submit its record of human rights violations in Afghanistan and Iraq, where approximately 900,000 people got killed. At the same time, Guantanamo Bay concentration camp is still operative." Maliha Hashmi, a journalist, UN consultant and trainer, tweeted, "The US, UK and Australia and other countries must be held accountable for human rights violations by their military in Afghanistan." Chen Zhu, China's UN envoy, tells Human Rights Council. Alex Rubinstein, an independent journalist, posted, "Eagerly awaiting a Pandora Papers-style info dump explaining where the money from Afghanistan's opium trade is sitting. Afghanistan went from having 7,606 hectares used for poppy cultivation in 2001 to 328,000